This is Pittsfield Community Radio, 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield, 88.1 WSBR Lee.
The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Living Well into the Future with your host, Julie B. Adler, where we introduce you to guests of all generations whose lived experience and expertise informs and stimulates us toward discussions and actions that foster living well ourselves and in our communities. You can listen to past episodes through the WTBRFM.com website and wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us and continue to write to us to let us know if their content gave rise to discussions or actions on your part. Let us know which episodes were relevant to your life, what you want to hear more about.
Write to us at lwitf22@gmail.com or through our website at livingwellintothefuture.com.
Where you can get more information about our guests, show notes, and information about past episodes.
Hi, and thank you. I'm your host, Julie B. Adler. Today is the last in our series on community and culture music. In the last two episodes, we spoke about how music creates communities of music lovers and music makers, about how music heals the body, mind, and spirit. Along the way, we've been trying to discover what the secret sauce is in music that makes connections that impede loneliness and create and bind communities. Our guests today, Bonnie Buick Brown, Daniel Anastasio, and Ryan Jose LeBoy, will help us find the answer. We'll speak with Bonnie about her deep experience connecting with listeners and collaborating with colleagues as a first violinist in the Boston Symphony Orchestra and other ensembles. We'll then turn to Daniel Anastasio, PhD, to talk about how, in his role as artistic director of three music organizations, he forges connections to the audience. And then we'll end this episode with Ryan LeBoy, singer, choral director, conductor, and PhD student, as he speaks of a powerful choral experience that bound and binds a nation. We'll start with Bonnie Buick Brown, a virtuoso violinist and arranger who has performed as a first violinist in the Boston Symphony Orchestra since 1987. While trained as a classical violinist, Bonnie's passion is bringing many forms of traditional and folk music to classical audiences. With that purpose in mind, she formed the group Classical Tangent in 2007, comprising BSO members and other traditional musicians. Bonnie also established the duo Frame with her brother, guitar player and songsmith Ken Buick. Bonnie played folk music with the group Child's Play and leads orchestra audition seminars all over the country, as well as teaching violin privately. Welcome, Bonnie Buick Brown, to Living Well into the Future.
Thank you.
Let's start right off with a really difficult question, but one that's key to our connection to music. As a musician, can you tell me what makes the magic in music?
I think a deep love for music. You can't just be good at it. You have to have a deep love and respect for the music. You have to have a dedication to your craft and the need to connect with your listener. Almost everybody in the Boston Symphony has all three of those. I don't think you can be a part of one of these higher institutions without a deep love, a great skill, and a need to present it. In the Boston Symphony, we're working on the connection. And as we evolve as an orchestra, especially our music director, who really instills that, we're getting better and better at the outreach and at reaching beyond the stage. But I think that's what makes, it's not just the term magic. It's what your listener experiences, right? And if they feel like part of a community, and if they feel like part of the performance, whether it's in a coffee house or on a stage, then the musical experience, then it's magical.
Listeners to past episodes in the series will remember outreach and the creating community are just what we talked about in our first part of this series with both Ryan LaBoy and Daniel Anastasio, and what you'll hear from Daniel later in this program. Bonnie, you have been a violinist in the Boston Symphony Orchestra for almost 40 years. During this period, how many conductors have come and gone?
Three. So when I joined, Seiji Ozawa was the music director, and he had been there for maybe 18 years. He was there for another 10. I think he was there for 28 seasons total. He was certainly a long-standing tradition with the orchestra. And then after that, we searched for a little while, a couple of years with no music director, and then James Levine was there for 7 years, I believe. And then again a search, and now we have Andres Nelson. So it's been three conductors.
So each very different. Each conductor, the repertoire changes, and you have to change with it.
True. I think Seiji's repertoire choices were the most balanced in that era. We were trying to forge new territory, trying to remain in the international spotlight, highlighting up-and-coming artists and new composers, but also wanting to keep our patrons coming back and satisfied. I remember one of my first weeks in the orchestra, and I don't remember who the composer is, my first month in the orchestra, there was a piece, a modern commission that featured the percussion section bouncing various types of ball, like basketball and tennis balls and those big rubber balls. And I just thought, wow, their job is so different. The programming was fairly balanced then, with a slant towards some French music. Seiji followed in the French tradition. The orchestra was an established French style orchestra. There were a lot of French people in the orchestra before I joined, the generation before. He took that role. And then James Levine was a real proponent of modern, of a few living composers like John Cage, Elliot Carter, and Warrenin. Music that was a head scratcher to me. He actually had a separate budget for these contemporary composers, and he was a huge fan of that. Also, opera. We still have a mission to play modern, to feature up-and-coming composers. I haven't seen any of the composers that he championed. It's all been different and new. And we had a relationship with Thomas Otis for several years. He was our composer in residence, and now it's Carlos Simon. So I think that's a very good idea for us. We really like to work with a composer. And it's not just the works that they bring. They also curate some concerts and speak to the audience. So it's much more of a relationship with both the orchestra and the audience. And all of that comes into community and comes into communication and trying to bring your audiences together and feel like they're part of the project.
And now you're in the Andres
Nelson's era. Yes.
How is that different from the others?
He is a very family-oriented person, so he's constantly encouraging that familial aspect. Every speech he gives, whether it's to the orchestra or the audience, talks about how we're all one big family. You audience members, you're so welcome in our home, this symphony hall, this beautiful building. He definitely waxes eloquent about inclusion. And with the orchestra, too, he's constantly talking about, I hope you had a good rest and your health is so important and we're here to make some beautiful music together. He knows all of our names. We've had barbecues with him. He's a colleague. He's a maestro, but he's a team player. He doesn't just say his speech. He means everything and he really connects with the orchestra. No music director is perfect, but he's very connected with us and we love our music director.
In terms of the music that he is bringing with him from the European tradition, how has that changed in terms of what you have to do, how the orchestra plays, how the audience reacts? Can you describe that?
He has made a project of all the works of Shostakovich. And so that's been major in the last 5 years. We've recorded everything Shostakovich ever wrote. By this time, we have, and we've won several Grammys for it. His depth of knowledge and his style in combination with the way this orchestra plays has been magical. He gets some really dark, beautiful colors that are very patient and sustained. And then the energy level that he brings to the high points is pretty dramatic. It's been a lot of fun to be involved in those projects. We're going on tour in May and bringing 4 Shostakovich symphonies on tour, as well as a cello concerto and a violin concerto. And that's going to be pretty exciting, I think. But a lot of Shostakovich. And I suggested that we bring a therapist on tour too, because
so are you constantly reacting and learning new techniques, new ways of addressing the music with each conductor or with the different pieces that are brought in?
I would say it's more pertinent to talk about the different conductors, because they all, whether it's our regular music director or our guest conductors, we're constantly reacting to their style and their way of rehearsing and their how much control they want to have and how much leeway they give the orchestra. For instance, one of our beloved conductors, Bernard Haitink, when he would conduct, he would play through and then find a few places in the piece to shape what he was hearing. He always reacted to our sound and to the orchestra rather than you're going to do it my way. He found ways to make our sound really pop or really convey a message that was in his heart. He found the perfect combination of a few words and using our sound. It was a really magical relationship that we had with him. And some younger conductors who are emerging and who are learning, they've studied the score and they have an idea of what they want to say with it, and they come with their notes. They lay it all on us. Some of their gestures are awkward and some are readable. It's just various combinations of how much experience they've had and how much control they want. We're constantly adjusting to their technique and personalities, but in terms of our own technique, that's what we were trained to do. We were trained to play as a section. We were trained to play anything that was put in front of us. Sometimes the music goes by so fast that you have to say to yourself, oh, this passage, this run is a brush stroke. And I'm going to come as close as I can, but really I need to get from here to here in an effective way. Maybe all of the sharps and flats, or the mixture of sharps and flats that this creative guy or woman wrote, maybe all of those are not as important as the gesture from the bottom to the top. We're trained for that. We know what to really zero in on, and we know how to play together. Some conductors' beats are maybe a little hard to understand. Our ears just really perk up and we're listening and playing off of each other. We also, as a family, know each other so well that we know that this person over here likes to stretch the ends of phrases and it's a beautiful thing. So no matter what we're doing, we're going to listen and we're going to go with the stretch at the end of the phrases. And we know that this person over here really, in their leadership, they like to move things along, and we know that about them. And there's never any, you don't even have to discuss it. We never discuss that. It's just something that happens in the orchestra. The adjustments that we make are from week to week and from piece to piece, but it is like a family. We know each other very well.
You talked about being a family, and that's a perfect segue to Child's Play, which was a group of virtuoso musicians playing traditional and contemporary fiddle music, of which you were one of the musicians. Violin maker Bob Child made all of the violins and violas of the members of the group, and he made one specifically for you. If your listeners want to hear it, there are two PBS specials the group made, which are available on PBS today. So how long did you play with Child's Play?
15 years. Yeah.
In addition to playing the violin, one of your creative roles in the group was as a music arranger. And in the PBS special, members of Coldplay talked about the collaborative nature of the group. Could you talk about that aspect of the group and your work as a music arranger?
What was wonderful about bringing in an arrangement, whether it was mine or anybody else's, was the process. You bring something with an idea in mind, and then the group takes it and says, what if we do this? And what if we thin it out over here? And what if we put the harp in the middle of it and have a little harp feature? It's just that process is pretty amazing. Those rehearsals where the piece just develops into how we're going to perform it.
And in terms of playing those pieces in a style, if it was Irish or Scottish, was there a musical identity? How did musical markers reflect the culture? And how did you reflect the culture of the music? Or was that not a consideration at all?
I'd say that was more of a consideration early on in Child's Play. Because those nuclei, those pods of people who played these different traditional music would have a little story to tell about the piece and where it came from and why they're playing it. And that's one of the reasons why the concerts went on for 3 hours. So the different styles were more delineated at that point. And as we came together as a streamlined the sound, it was more of a New England fiddle tradition that we were bringing. That being said, I would bring like a gypsy piece and somebody else would bring something that was really Irish and they would say, this is from West Clare and Paddy Canny made it famous and we're going to play it and this is how it's going to go. We were honoring traditions, but also trying to adhere to this New England fiddle style.
You talked about gypsy music, and I just heard your chamber music quartet perform a piece of gypsy music that you arranged.
Correct.
So when you take a piece of traditional music, how do you go about arranging it in terms of the genre, the style, the culture again? Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. In gypsy music, which is a very broad term, of course, because it's Slavic and it comes from different regions, but in the broad sense of the word, the violin or fiddle was used as a storytelling device. So if you picture a bunch of people sitting around a campfire and somebody would bring out the fiddle and play something, it was very evocative of a mood. And a lot of their music has titles like Bear Dance or Wedding Celebration, Fire and Whatever, or Sadness. So they're always trying to express a theme or a story. The violin is, maybe I don't need to say much more. It's really an evocative mood that the violin is trying to create. So there's a lot of exaggerated sounds and maybe unrefined sounds that are not found in classical music. For instance, when we were working on this piece, we were trying to make the trills really messy, like really wide, instead of a tight little classical trill. We were trying to wing the trill a little bit more to make it more exotic sounding. Also, the fast passages needed to be really fiery. And some of the rhythms can be exaggerated a little bit. If it's kind of a Scottish sounding rhythm, which we used in this Polonaise, we tried to exaggerate it so that it was a little bit more whipped. Yeah, so the music really, if it doesn't tell an exact story, it's at least very evocative and imagistic, and it makes you feel something.
How did you learn that those were the characteristics of a gypsy piece?
Just by listening. I don't think I studied the culture except for where the pieces came from. And I have to say, I use that a lot in my teaching to try to get my students. I have a studio of 6 students right now. And I talk about, what do you want your listener to feel? What do you want them to hear? Because a lot of people can play these notes, but what do you want to say? If there's a passage that lends itself to this, I say, how would you play this if you were around a campfire and you were using this instrument to tell a story about being lost in the woods, or about encountering a bear, or about walking your dog, whatever, it doesn't matter. But what do you want your listener to hear? That's always really spoken to me, and just how to express yourself through your instrument. If you're a singer, you're singing directly to the audience, and you're also singing words. You have your voice facing the audience, and you're singing words that mean something. But as a violin, you're focused on your instrument, and what you're expressing is going through your instrument and then out to the audience. If you don't connect with them at all, if you're just playing and looking at music and playing what's on the page, you're really missing a big part of your communication and connection with your audience.
Thank you very much, Bonnie Buick-Brown. You've shown us how much communication and collaboration goes into the making and playing of music.
My pleasure. It's been wonderful talking to you.
Turn to Daniel Anastasio, who we spoke with in our first music segment. Like Bonnie, Daniel trained as a classical musician. Although of different generations, they may have crossed paths when Daniel was a fellow at Tanglewood, the summer home of the Boston Symphony, in 2011. To learn how Daniel establishes connections between his music, the musicians, and the audience, we'll focus on his role as artistic director. Welcome again, Daniel Anastasio. One of the hats that you wear is as artistic director of 3 groups that I know of: Agorita, the San Antonio Chamber Society, and Heard of Ensemble. Can we start with your process of putting together a program for each of these groups? What input do you use in putting together those programs?
Yeah, I think a lot of my programs come first from people. One of the most important things about Agorita and what we do is collaboration with poets, other artists, other musicians, maybe even a space like a museum. I get a lot of my inspiration from outside of my own brain, because who am I? I'm a classical pianist trained in a very particular way at schools like Juilliard and Stony Brook University. I was taught within the system of Western European art music, and I'm very grateful for that. I think it has some of the absolute best music ever written. However, I feel like the success that we've had with some of my programs is that it comes from a desire to connect with someone or something that is local. When I work with the poet Naomi Nye, for example, on a program, the first thing that happens is we have a Zoom. I dig into her work and I dig into her mind, and I really get a strong sense of what she's after as an artist. That immediately leads to inspiration for me. I start to pick from the library of musical pieces in my brain from my own training that would connect to those fundamental emotions and expressions she's expressing in her poetry. This is where some of the connection lies. It's not like classical music has its own special set of emotions. I think these are universal human conditions that great artists bring out in their work. It just so happens that Beethoven is doing that, let's say, through a series of harmonies and characters and textures through the piano or through the violin. But someone like Naomi does that in her poetry. Someone like Jeannie Garcia does it with her glass blowing. Someone like Azul Barrientos does it with her singing and songwriting from her Mexican tradition. So I come from a place of believing that the foundations of human expression are in every soul and are in every art form. And I think it's my job to try to connect people to those no matter what the art form. So I can find that in collaboration more easily, where another art form is inspiring me to add a musical piece on the program that will speak to the same sort of emotional realm, and thereby enhancing each art form enhances each other, so that we're getting more entry points for the listener, who are also viewing something, not just listening, but watching a kind of show. What needs to happen more than anything is a reaching out toward that community in order to either remove barriers so people can more easily access and listen to it, and educate people to demonstrate that there's nothing so scary or complicated or elitist about any of this music, and I'll show you how it can connect to something in your very own community.
I was in the audience when Agarita played with Pablo Sanz-Viegos. You had a full house. How many seats are there in the Tobin Center?
Something like 1,700 people, maybe close to 2,000.
Very diverse in age and cultures. This is the second time I think you've had programs with him. The audience response to the work was overwhelming. People really appreciated the program. So could you talk about one, building that audience to respond in that way? Yes, it was an excellent performance. If you looked at the audience, people came from different backgrounds. I think I read somewhere that your musical affiliations are cemented when you are a teenager. Those are the things that you respond to most comfortably. So could you talk about that event?
Yeah, absolutely. That kind of success of a concert does not happen overnight. It takes years. What we've built with our audience is the feeling that they know and understand us, not just the music. In fact, I think the connection that we personally have as performers and musicians to our audience is the thing that attracts people most to our concerts. We all make sure to talk to our audience between every piece, and pieces are not too lengthy. And you probably noticed nothing I program tends to be more than 5 to 8 minutes long. It's rare where I get a 10 plus minute piece. The entire length of the concert is no longer than 75 minutes. And there's talking throughout. We're very careful about what we say. We think about it. We plan it out. It's not word for word. We have a spontaneity for sure. But we acknowledge that's an extremely important part of connecting with the audience and building an audience, is that they feel personally connected to us. That is something that is not really taught in conservatory. I strongly believe that every music department program, every music major should have a public speaking course, because that's as important as your ability to perform these days. The music does not speak for itself. I really feel that. In this day and age, at least for the kind of repertoire that we tend to program, a listener needs and should have a little guidance in what to listen for, permission to listen. I think there's a lot of fear built around listening to this kind of music over the past century. And we're trying to just slowly remove the layers of that onion, making the concerts free and accessible to everyone, going around our community in an outdoor truck to play in all 10 districts of San Antonio, all free of charge, So if someone doesn't feel like listening indoors, or they don't feel like going into a concert hall, or they're not sure what that feels like or means, they can listen to that same music outside. Going into schools and playing for elementary school students, all of this helps to make the feeling of listening to a classical concert less removed. And then we get to the repertoire itself. I'm programming for that concert, the Pablo Sáenz Viegas concert in Tobin Center, in a way that highlights our collaborator, who's Spanish. So it was a lot of Spanish-influenced music, Latin American music too, music by Piazzolla, Clarissa Saad, who has actually been to San Antonio, Alberto Ginastera, another Argentinian, and finding music that might speak to a Spanish-speaking culture, which is San Antonio. I don't know the exact numbers, but certainly more than 50% of San Antonio speaks Spanish and has that influence. Allowing for that cultural influence to be there in a very unapologetic and non-forced way, I think is significant. The fact that all of our programs are bilingual, our program notes are in Spanish and English, and our cellist, Ignacio Gallego, is from Spain and speaks Spanish to our audience. All of that can contribute to making an audience feel more relaxed, feel included, feel like this is as much theirs as it is ours, and that we're sharing something already part of a community they are part of. So it's important for, I think, for them to feel a certain ownership of us, to feel like we belong to them as San Antonians, and that we're delivering this music for them as a gift, that, hey, look, we are honored to be in this community, and the least we can do is give back this incredible music that we've learned. So all of that is setting up the listening process in the most positive possible way, so that you're setting yourself up for success. In order for them to really hate our concert, they'd have to really hate what we're doing, because we're offering it for free. We're breaking down a lot of barriers that you'd normally find in classical music and trying to be as relatable as possible to make this music accessible.
That raises the question, is this sustainable? How do you give free concerts?
We have found a lot of success in this model. I was at a music festival a long time ago. The executive director went on stage and said, ticket sales make up only a fraction of what we need for our budget in order to put these festivals on. And please, can you donate in order to make this happen? And I thought, if it's really only a fraction, why not remove that barrier? It's frankly just a more compelling, If you're able to provide free classical music for the whole community without any barriers, and you're inviting everyone in, then there are bound to be philanthropic individuals in that community who also support that mission. And that's what we found. Not only are we supported by individual donors who believe in that mission of providing free classical music to everyone and making it as accessible as possible in order to reshape people's relationship to classical music, but we're also funded by the city, we're winning grants, and we have a couple of corporations who are stepping in to help us. As a nonprofit who relies on the philanthropy of its community, we wanted to work on a mission that would be the strongest and most compelling for those donors. So it worked. It just worked in tandem, where it was like, yeah, this is a noble mission. And I think people will see that as a noble mission and want to give to it. And that's been really proven to be correct. I can't speak for every city. I can't speak for every community, obviously. And I think there's a lot of luck involved. There's chemistry between the four individuals that we are and the city that we're in. There's also timing and all kinds of things. But this is a model that has so far been proven really successful, and there doesn't seem to be any slowing down after 7 years.
Very positive to talk about that in a time when we need the community to step in and be a positive force. Is it different when you are programming for the unheard of ensemble?
Oh, absolutely. And I work with the executive director, Ford Firquin, our clarinetist, on that. We've done a great job in that group to create shows that really interact meaningfully with the community. We're based in Brooklyn. I don't live there, but I fly there for concerts. And with our shows on the Gowanus Canal, where we collaborate with the Gowanus dredgers, we have outdoor concerts. It brings out people in the Brooklyn community who are craving a sense of community and are looking for social impact. We provide a platform and a space for that to happen. We're allowing for that conversation to occur by existing as a performing arts group. We premiere pieces. Almost entirely what Unheard of does is play the works of young composers coming up. And so we're giving voice to new artists who are trying to make changes in their community through their art. Without groups like us to turn their ideas into sound, those ideas don't develop into potentially community-changing ideas. We feel like in a lot of ways we're a stepping stone for composers who need to find their own voice. We are the developing factor sometimes that will provide feedback for a composer to develop their next piece, their next voice, their next mission, and their next messaging. On one hand, we're creating a community space just by having the event. On another, we feel like we're developing the kind of voices in the new music field by allowing their music to be heard. It's such an important part of developing as a composer. It's throughout time, composers need their works to be played live. They can't just listen back on a computer. It's not the same. I can't tell you how many times we've played or workshopped a piece with the composer, and the first thing they said is, oh my God, this is so unbelievable. It sounds so different than what I imagined, and I'm learning so much. And then we work with them on the piece. It's very rewarding, that creation process together. And it's something I uniquely get to do in that ensemble.
Contrast that with the San Antonio Chamber Music Society, which has been around for, 75 years?
That's an old institution for sure.
Yeah, and an older audience.
Yeah, so, I would say that older audiences are more open-minded than people usually think or assume. I think it's often a mistake that directors, okay, we have an older crowd, so we better be careful with the new stuff. It's not the idea that the older crowd is more educated and they can understand this music, whereas a younger crowd maybe can't. I think everyone needs that level of accessibility and a kind of reaching out from the performer to say, hey, I know we don't live in the year 1700 or 1800. Here are some things to listen for. I've been doing this stuff since I was 5. Why should I expect you to understand the inner workings of music? Even if you listen to it, even if you're an utter appreciator, I promise you, I can help you listen in a more careful way to this particular music.
In the case of the Chamber Music Society, you are selecting the artists, the groups, rather than planning the programs. Is that right?
Yeah, me and Pauline Glickman, as part of the artists committee, select the artists, and then they usually provide an option of programs. And then we can't force them, but we can give strong suggestions. We can say, this might not work for this crowd, or why don't we try something a little more experimental or a little less experimental? And they generally trust us based on the community. And I think that's valuable. I think that managers and worldwide artists and directors are starting to recognize that community matters. Where you're playing matters. It's not a one-size-fits-all kind of situation, nor should it be. I think that people are waking up to that. And I do see a change coming where people are being more sensitive to the communities in which they play. And I hope that something like Agorita is a model for musicians everywhere to say, we can just start something in our own community. We don't need to get management and then be hired to tour around the country and then try to make a living on these tours where I'm just playing concert after concert of the same repertoire. I can actually build something in the community that I live in, so long as I'm communicating with them and speaking to them and understanding what their desires are, and then offer my own expertise. That is ultimately going to bring in more audience and build stronger relationships than just flying in, playing a concert, and leaving.
Thank you, Daniel. You've given us a really good idea of what it takes to consider, build, and convey the music that we as listeners receive with appreciation of your efforts. Ryan LaBoy, it's good to speak with you again.
Yeah, Julie, it's great to speak with you as well.
As a singer and choral conductor, you had, after the fall of the Soviet Union, the opportunity to go to Estonia and take place in an event that demonstrates the power of music dramatically. Can you tell us about it?
I was at the University of Minnesota studying conducting, and my professor and mentor, Kathy Romy, encouraged me to apply for a fellowship through the Immigration History Research Center at the University of Minnesota. One of those fellowships was to Estonia. And what I knew about Estonia at the time, this is in 2013 going on 14, and that's just a significant year. What I knew about Estonia at the time from a previous musical performance that I did is that Estonia had what is called the Singing Revolution as part of their history. This is a fascinating thing. So in 89, 90, 91, in that era, Estonia had what is now called the Singing Revolution. And it is one of the only successful bloodless breaks away from the Soviet bloc in history. There was no bloodshed in this claiming of independence. And what made that possible was the Estonian people's strong connection to singing together. This goes back to the late 19th century. Every 5 years, Estonia has a singing festival called Laulupidu. Laul means singing or song in Estonian. And so Laulupidu is every 5 years, the Estonian people, and it's like maybe a million people in Estonia. It's a very small country. But from all over the country, folks come together from their towns and regions, and they form a mass choir, and they sing these songs together over a multi-day festival. And so now, fast forwarding to 2013-14, that choir is 25 to 30,000 people in one choir amassed. It's so huge that in Estonia, there's a dedicated festival grounds for it. And so you have 30,000 people singing on a stage under this band shell, and you have another 150,000 people sitting in the audience. I mean, it's just nuts. I went to Estonia to study this phenomenon. It's fascinating. What I was looking at in Estonia was the confluence of generations at that point in time, because the grandparents who are still participating in that festival grew up in a Soviet country where the only time they often felt they could express their ethnic identity or pride in their heritage was once every 5 years for this festival. The Russian government allowed this to continue. There's plenty of reason, but we don't have to go into that right now. So you have this generation of folks for whom this marker once every 5 years was deeply significant for the opportunity to express their cultural values. The second generation would be my parents' generation, who were active in the break away from the Soviet bloc, who strategically operationalized and weaponized singing and the tradition of the song festival to protest and break away from Soviet Russia. So two totally different functions. And then you have this third generation now coming into the age of majority, which would have been my generation of Estonians who never knew life in an occupied country and don't know what it means to only have this festival every 5 years. And so that festival in 2014 was fascinating for me because I wanted to understand differently how these three generations come together and how is the festival changing? What does it represent for, if you were to make an aggregate statement about what the festival means to Estonians today? That's what I was interrogating. I happened to be on a train coming from a festival in Eastern Estonia, and I asked a woman for the time, and she happened to be a sociologist at the university in Tallinn. And serendipity is just huge. She happened to be the daughter-in-law of the conductor at the university, And so she arranged for me to meet with the conductor. She arranged for me to meet up with Monica, and she offered to translate for me, which is an enormous gift because Estonian is incredibly hard to speak. I knew how to ask simple things like, can you tell me the time? Where is the bathroom? Can I have cream with my coffee? The important stuff. So Monica and I had this interview that was translated, and the more I asked her about these questions relating to generations and the festival, she said, really, the only way for you to truly understand this is to experience it. And so then she offered me to sing with her choir. She said, how's your Estonian? And I said, I can't speak it, but I can pronounce it like it's my job. So she invited me to sing in this festival, and I got to march in this huge parade with her choir and sing in this festival of 25 to 30,000 people. And just like deeply profound. I think about where we are today in the United States culturally and how this education that I received in Estonia may function in my life, a singing revolution. Like, there are tangible ways that singing can move peoples. And Estonia is a really brilliant example of this. When I think about working with the concert choir, you've asked me about my experience with the children's chorus. The concert choir, we live in a city of 40,000 people in Pittsfield. It's not a huge city. This region isn't huge. So any assembly of, right now, we have close to 90 singers in the chorus. Any assembly of 90 adults in a community of 40,000 people can do really powerful things. One way of holding that community together or cultivating what Robert Putnam would call social capital and just having that on standby is through our weekly rehearsals and the concerts that we perform. And so who knows what way we'll be tasked to operationalize the work of the concert choir. But now more than ever, connecting back to Estonia, I am so thankful for the education that I have on that country and their history and the way they used singing and choir particularly, because it just feels so prescient today. It feels so important today with the frail state of American democracy.
You have hit upon the issue of community and culture.
There's so much to be said about singing under occupation and the way that it was a propagandist endeavor, and yet the Estonians, through their language, were able to subvert message and code message. And in one song in particular, Mui Sama on Minu Arm, to sing that song, one song every 5 years, provided in some way enough fuel for the journey for the Estonian people to get them to the next 5 years. One song every 5 years was powerful enough to keep them connected and together. My gosh, that's just amazing.
It really is. I thought it was fascinating how music worked to unite the country, to create the identity that survived occupation and attempted obliteration. You've traveled to other countries and participated in choral opportunities in other places. Do others come to mind that reflect that kind of unity of culture or bringing together of people?
At the scale of Estonia, my initial response is no, not to my knowledge. And that's purely to my knowledge. I don't doubt that somewhere that is happening. The Baltic states as a whole, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, do have very strong folk singing and dance traditions. So you could look at Latvia, for example, or you could look at Lithuania, but those are pretty similar contexts to Estonia. And certainly in relation to their occupation by the USSR in the 20th century.
Ryan, what, didn't you go to Africa as well?
I was not studying choral music in Africa. I was studying drumming and dance, which is lovely and wonderful. I was studying in Ghana, in the southeast region of Ghana. There is strong social cohesion and a sense of identity and rootedness. I was staying with the Ewe people, for example. So like within specific tribes, right, there are different, one like really superficial difference would be like does the music of a particular tribe use stick drumming or hand drumming? Are you using sticks to play the instrument or using your hands to play the instrument? Oftentimes we think of Africa and playing instruments. We very quickly think of the djembe, for example, which is a hand drum. But in Ewe culture, they typically use stick drums, right? So I think within those tribal lines, maybe more so than national lines in the way that we see in Estonia, there is more sort of cultural unity and coming together around that. But as far as I know, it's not been used to the scale politically or socially as it has been in Estonia. One of the challenges of my research in Estonia, and this just came up this past week in my doctoral seminar, is the difference between a homogenous and a heterogeneous culture or a society. In Estonia, for example, it is perhaps easier to unify behind this body of song because the ethnic makeup of the country is more homogeneous than it is not, right? This past week in seminar, a colleague and I were talking about Robert Putnam's theory of social capital and the way in which music ensemble performance can be used as a means of developing or fostering social capital. And that's really lovely to say, right? That by singing together or by playing in a band together, by playing in an orchestra together, that we, the three sort of phases of social capital are bridging, bonding, and linking, right? We can bridge backgrounds, bond together, and then leverage that bond to serve a greater social need or problem. The challenge in the United States is we are so diverse. How do you develop social capital through a musical performance? And how successful can you be in doing that in an American context when even at the local level, communities can be so vastly diverse from one another?
It makes me think about the Star Spangled Banner that we, you know, when I was growing up, we sang it every day and it became a unifying anthem. And everybody of every color, size, and whatever would feel moved, would identify with that. And it seems to me the Estonian one that you talked about was that kind of Star Spangled Banner.
Yes, I would absolutely agree. But I would say your perception of the Star Spangled Banner, I would maybe challenge that and say that's your perspective from the community that you knew. But within the United States, there are a lot of people who maybe don't think in the same way. Even back when you were singing the national anthem as a perfunctory exercise, I'm certain that that's propaganda. That's the U.S. through its education system and its music teachers telling you when you sing this song, you should feel this. And so then we have this assumption, oh, when people sing this song, we all feel this. And maybe that does end up being true for lots of people, but there's always been problems to be found with the national anthem.
That's a good example of perhaps a generational difference in reaction, as well as the difference between the reception of the piece in a more homogeneous and less heterogeneous society. Thank you, Ryan LaBoy, for sharing your knowledge and experience with us once again. And thank you, listeners, for listening. I hope we all agree that all of our guests have left us with a deeper understanding of the complex collaborations and considerations that contribute to our connections, both physical and emotional, to music.
We hope that you enjoyed this episode and found food for thought and further discussion with family, friends, and the wider community. If you want to repeat this episode and hear others, you can find them at Living Well Into the Future on 89.7 WTBR Pittsfield, 88.1 WSBR Lee, WTBRFM.com, Apple Podcasts, and other streaming services. Subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. We invite you to contribute to Living Well Into the Future with your comments and suggestions for topics and even guests. Write to us at lwitf22@gmail.com or through our website at livingwellintothefuture.com, where you can find show notes, past episodes, and information about our guests.
Our thanks to WTBR-FM, the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at BCC, and the Berkshire Eagle for their support. This podcast is produced by Julie Copenheffer. Our music is written and performed by Michael Copenheffer. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and not of WTBR-FM, Berkshire Ollie, or the Berkshire Eagle, or the LWITF production team.